All right, guys, here's the deal. Before I even start this today, what I want to do is I want to give out the Veterans Crisis Support Line. And the reason for that is if anything we say gets you in a position where you feel that you need help immediately, I want you to go ahead and call them because I am not a doctor. I am not a psychiatrist or a psychologist, and I will attempt to help you in the best ways that I can, but they're better at it than I am. So it's 1-800-273-8255. And if you call and you're a veteran, press the number one and they will get you immediately on the line with somebody who can help you. And that's it. So let's go ahead and start the program. 1-800-273-8255. Don't forget, 1-800-873-8255. Hello and welcome to this next episode here of Post Combat Normal. My name is Joe Morgan, your host, and today I have another friend here with me today. His name is Brennan Tuohy. He's a Vietnam veteran, a Marine with a reconnaissance unit. In his time in Vietnam, he went on 27 combat patrols. Of those, only 5 did not end in enemy contact. He's been a friend of mine for the last 7 years or so, and during that time he's gone through the Vet Center program that we talk about on here quite a bit. And he has something he wants to read for us today, and first he wants to give a brief intro to it. So, Brennan, welcome to the program, and what are you going to do for us today, man?
Well, Joe, you did a good job of introducing me. Thank you very much. I showed up in Vietnam in March of 1968 and was a PFC right out of boot camp and training. And about 8 months later, I was leading patrols. And the reason I bring that up is because of the fact that it shows some credibility to the fact that I was a good Marine, damn proud of it. I actually think I still am a good Marine. That's about it.
Okay, and you're going to read something you wrote. Give me a brief history of what borrowed time means to you. I guess, how can I put this? So how did you come to write Borrowed Time? What is it, and what does it mean to you?
Well, actually, Borrowed Time more erupted out of me than the fact that I wrote it, because I did not sit down and say, oh, I'm going to write a poem. In 2008, I was awakened by my buddy Cal Butterfield, and after Cal left, I immediately got up, went to my computer, and wrote it down. It just, as I said, erupted from me. The interesting part of it is Cal died almost 40 years to the day of me writing the poem or having the poem come out of me, and he was killed in Vietnam, died of his wounds. And I suffered long and hard over him, and still miss him a lot.
Definitely understand that sentiment. There's certain days on a calendar that tear us up. There's no way around it. There's people who don't seem to understand that certain days, man, you just don't go out in public. Certain days you stay in the darkness and you just hide that day because, you know, that date on a calendar to you means something different than everybody else. So go ahead and read it to us. I mean, I've heard it before, but I want everybody to hear it because it is a very, very powerful poem.
I came close to meeting you many times long ago, yet here I am still breathing and humbled to do so. Trying to bargain for just another sunrise, I told you I would always walk with you. You kept your end of the bargain. I have tried to keep mine. Thank you, Lord, for borrowed time. Not living out of a pack with never an ounce of slack. No heat to cook my brain, not sleeping in the rain. No hills too steep to climb, not living in dirt and grime. Not able to shake the fear, not able to shed a tear. Thank you, Lord, for borrowed time. When I made it home, I just wanted to be left alone. No dive too deep, no jump too high, no speed too fast. Never a prediction of my addiction. Adrenaline, my drug of choice, with no rejoice. Never enough to cleanse my soul, never enough to make me whole. Blessed with a woman of my dreams, mother to my children, my beauty queen, counselor to my darker side. Yes, counselor to that dark side. Thank you, Lord, for borrowed time. If it's true a coward dies 1,000 deaths and a brave man but once, then why do these brave men die again and again in my dreams? My brothers dying over and over in my dreams. Thank you, Lord, for borrowed time. I've tried to live the life of a man on borrowed time. I pray I've honored the men who were denied their full time. Why is it me and not them left to live a life on borrowed time? I came close to meeting you many times long ago, yet here I am still breathing and humbled to do so. Trying to bargain for just another sunrise, I told you I would always walk with you. You have kept your end of the bargain. I have tried to keep mine. Thank you, Lord, for borrowed time.
All right, Brendan, I really wanted to thank you for reading that. And there's a particular part of your poem that really hits me the hardest, and it's, if a true coward dies 1,000 deaths and a brave man but once, then why do these brave men die again and again in my dreams, my brothers dying over and over in my mind? Thank you, Lord, for borrowed time. And that piece, if you've felt what we've felt, that piece is so true, because when you go to sleep at night, you see the same guys in their last moments. And I wanted to ask you, while going through your trauma therapy, have you learned a way to dream of them differently, to think of them differently, to where they're not in those moments at night when you're alone?
That's a tough one, buddy. Well, particularly with Cal. Yeah, he came back and told me he was okay. Cal was just a character. He always had a smile on his face and just a goofy bastard. He used to say, I'm the seventh son of a seventh son. My daddy's a pistol. I'm a son of a gun. There ain't no gook in the world bad enough to kill me. And then he died of wounds after he was medevaced out of country. And you're not supposed to die of wounds. And for a long, long time, I thought that he had given up. And then I was able to contact the corpsman that got him medevaced. And he told me that he got to the Philippines and they got as much of the shrapnel out as possible, and that one morning they woke up, they go to wake him up and he was gone, and they left some shrapnel in him, and he must have been doing Cal stuff, goofy stuff, and severed an artery and hemorrhaged to death. That's the only thing I can do it. And it was a blessing to find out that he hadn't given up, but it was just still really, really tough to know that he's gone.
Now, when you say he came back to you, can you explain to the people who haven't been to a trauma group what you mean by that and how that came about?
Well, I guess I have a blessing and a curse in the same time, because I don't remember my dreams.
Okay.
I just wake up in a panic.
And sweat through your sheets and that kind of fun stuff.
And then when I wake up, the first thing that comes to my mind is what I think I've been dreaming about. And Cal's face came to me just as clear as a bell. So I must have been dreaming about him. Or I like to think he came to visit me so he could tell me he was okay. 19-year-old. I've been at home now over twice as long as he is. He was alive, and it just doesn't seem fair.
One of the things that, I mean, hell, the name of the poem is Borrowed Time. And one of the things that you say is, why is it me, not him? And that's such a common symptom of what we go through, of survivor's guilt and saying, why did that bullet hit him? Why did that shrapnel hit him? Why was I not in that truck? Why was I not standing in that spot? Why? And you stay up at night and you think about it and you cry yourself to sleep about it sometimes. And I say you, I mean me, you know. I don't mean anybody else. I mean me. This is what I do. And it's a painful thing to live with, but have you found any relief? Have you found any help through the trauma group? Have you found any help through the PTSD group that makes it to where you can carry it differently, to where you can feel it differently? I mean, I know it's never going to go away. Good God, it's never going to go away. You have these scars inside you, and you're always going to have the scar, but can you think about him now in a better way than you used to?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I guess a lot of the guilt also is because I wasn't there. He was in first recon. I was in third recon. I went to visit him because I was on my way TDY somewhere else. And I found out that he had been killed or died. And So I walked around for like 7 months still in country, knowing that he was gone. And I didn't have any control over it. The fact that I wasn't there to protect him was a lot of the guilt as well. Although what good I could have done had I been there, no one will ever know.
Most of survivor guilt isn't logical. It doesn't matter that you couldn't have done anything. It matters that you wonder if you could have. It doesn't make any damn difference that, you know, if we talk about myself and a friend of mine, we talk about being in a truck that didn't make it, and we were in it a week early or whatever the case may be, maybe 2 weeks. I'm bad with memory. And the only difference is we'd be dead too. I mean, there's no – but somehow maybe we'd have seen it. Maybe we would have seen the ambush 2 seconds before, you know, whatever. And you wouldn't have. You wouldn't have. You wouldn't have done anything except be dead too. And that's logical, but at night when the darkness and the demons come, that's when we think about these things. So I want people to understand that there's help and there's ways to carry these memories differently and to feel healthier about it and to be able to have a more healthy emotional relationship with those that you've lost, to have a more healthy emotional relationship with the people that you weren't there with when they died, the people that you took their lives, whatever the case may be, whatever your personal trauma is, to know that there is ways that these doctors, ways that these psychologists or psychiatrists can assist you and can talk to you about carrying their memory differently. And so I'm going to move on.
I'd like to add something. Okay. We were at the vet center during the counseling there. We were asked to write a letter to our dearly departed. I don't know how else to say, because he was a dear friend of mine. And I wrote him, and I was angry that he died. I let him have it. And I told him that, just, you know, how dare you have died after you promised me you weren't going to. And, man, I'll tell you what, I felt better. I felt better for telling him exactly what he did wrong and then leaving me. It's like, what do you mean? He left his family. He didn't leave me, but I took it real personal.
I say this all the time to different vets, but I'm closer to you than your family is, because I've seen the demon too. And I don't mean it to replace your family, but like myself and Andy, my other friend that's sitting here with us today, I'm closer to him than I am to almost anybody else on this planet. And it's because we know each other. We know each other in that intimate moment where things are real, where you're in a place that – where things get really real. Again, I'm going to stop, but
– that realness is not actually always have to be in a combat, but you live with a person 24/7, 365, and you get much tighter than blood.
Well, and you're in a place where you're both young. You're both I don't want to say flippant. That's the wrong word. But we can say anything to each other. Two Marines sitting in a hut in the middle of nowhere with rifles in their hands will say things that are more intimate. Again, I use the word intimate. What I mean is just closeness. So people who think of that as a man-woman kind of thing, no. I mean the real intimacy of, I know more about you. I know more about the real you, the deep inner you, than anyone else on this planet, because – I've sat in an OP with you for 14 hours as we talked about nothing, and we both thought we might die. And so you're really bearing your soul to each other at that deep level, and you become friends that can't be replaced. And when one of them is lost, you can never fix it. You can never replace it. And the best you can do is, instead of holding their memory in a sad way, learn to use it for good. I'll give an example. On certain days of the year, we talked about earlier, there are certain calendar days that make me not want to go outside. They make me want to cry. They make me want to feel horrible. And I could read off all the dates, but I just don't want to get that emotional right now. But bottom line is, I decided to change my mind. And instead of staying at home and crying about it, I try to go out and I try to do something. And on that day, in my own head, nobody else in the world knows this. Nobody else in the world knows that I have a day where I go out and I call it by the name of the person that died that day, and I say, today I'm going to do something good for him. Today I'm going to do something good because Brian died today, and I owe Brian, or I could name people, and I don't want to, but to understand that, you know, on that day, instead of holding it in a negative light where I say, why am I alive? I say, how about if I do something for that guy today? How about if I, you know, anything?
And that's really excellent advice, really, really excellent advice.
Because you can wallow in it or you can I'm a grunt, man, so sometimes I say things and I want you to understand I'm not a psychologist, I'm not a psychiatrist. So if I say get over it, I don't mean it in the sense of like I'm being rude. I mean I tell myself in the mirror that morning, you have to get over it, you have to go outside, you have to do something positive, and it's not easy, and every time it makes me cry, but you do it. You do it because it's what he would want you to do. He would want you to have a good life. Do you think that 40 years later he wants you crying about him? And that's the question that you have to ask when the logical goes away and the demons come at night. You have to ask yourself, does Cal want you to cry right now, or does Cal want you to celebrate the fact that you do have air in your lungs and live a life for him? And I'm asking you, even though I know what my answer is and what most guys' answer is, we still go, oh, well, what if? But that's what you have to try to do, and that's what those psychiatrists, psychologists help you do at the vet center. That's the whole point of all this, is they have ways of assisting you do that. So moving on, there are a few other things that I know you did with the borrowed time. I actually got to sit through one of them. You and help me out with this. I call it Cola Voce?
Cola Voce.
Okay, Cola Voce. They're a choral group. Mm-hmm. Go ahead and explain what happened there and how that came to pass, that you got to share your poem in a music form with a lot of people.
It's a good story. Frankly, before I met Cola Voce, I thought a choral group was a rock underneath the ocean that I got to dive on. And then a woman who is a music therapist of our – a friend of ours, Tara McDonald, she – I contacted her about – because I hear this song as a country music song. It's country. And I've sent this the poem to numerous different country artists, hoping that they would like it and convert it to country music. But it hasn't availed itself yet. But in the meantime, Tara contacted the director, Janine, of the Cola Voce. Janine was able to hook up with a music composer out of Texas, and he spent, I think, the better part of 9 months putting this to music. They performed, that's the word I'm looking for, performed Borrowed Time as an original piece of music for Cola Voce in May of 2013. And I was very, very fortunate to be able to go to the rehearsals and listen to it and hear it develop. And it is beautiful. My only regret about the whole thing is that we didn't get it professionally recorded, so it can't be heard by many, many people. But the composer, and his name escapes me right at the moment.
Is that Bill Brunswick?
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
He in the time constraints, they were only able to use about three of the six stanzas in the presentation. So he wants to make it a full presentation because it went 11 minutes, I believe, with just the three stands, and he wants to make it about a half an hour presentation. And he's still working on it. I haven't heard from him in some time, but he's still working on it. And
it's hard to write music that's that emotional. It's hard to, you know, one of the things that he had said when he was being interviewed is how he had to live with it, and he read the poem hundreds of times, just the first line to understand where you were when you wrote it and how you felt. Because to write it with the right emotion, you have to understand that emotion. You have to feel that emotion. So it's hard. And to imagine that he's going to make it 30 minutes long, I mean, it's going to take a minute.
Interestingly enough, it's kind of interesting in that I heard the poem anew after I heard his presentation and the performance. As I said, the poem just came out of me. I didn't write it. It just erupted from me. So to hear it from him, it just gave it a completely multidimensional meanings to it.
So
it was a conglomeration of Tara, Janine, Bill, myself, and the whole choral group. It was amazing.
Well, I was lucky enough to be able to come to one of their performances of it, and and you know, and see your reaction to it, see how they performed it, see everything about it. I went to the one up in Grass Valley, if you remember, and mm-hmm. it was amazing. It is different when something – music makes you feel different than words. And to have both of them together, one of the things we did afterwards, and it's still – I still think about it quite a bit, is afterwards we wrote down those that we lost. And we well, you can maybe tell that story better than I can, but we wrote down the names of people that we had lost, and we – I'm not going to say said goodbye to them, but we put them on a piece of paper. We took them in the back, and we lit a candle for them, and it was healing. It was a very healing moment, and it – sometimes you wish that you could bottle certain things up and hand them out to people. And that's one of those moments I wish I could hand out to people and say, you need to feel this. You need to understand what this type of healing is, because I'm a Marine sergeant, man. I'm an infantry sergeant. I don't feel things. I don't do things. I'm hardcore. I don't ever do any of that crap. And then one day you do, because you have to. And you realize, holy shit, there's something to all this therapy, and there's something to this lighting of a candle, and there's something to writing a poem. You think when you were 19 years old in Vietnam, you ever thought, I'm going to be a poet one day. I'm going to write down a poem. That's the last thing from your mind. That no longer, you know, I mean, I'm speaking for you, but that didn't enter your mind any more than I'm going to grow wings out of my butt and fly to the moon. I mean, the odds of me being a poet are zero.
Well, zero. Zero.
And then you find out that these things help, and they make your heart lighter, and they make you feel better about the memory of your friend. They make you feel better about a lot of things, and there's a reason people all do this, and it's not because we're all quacks. It works. So
those names, Janine, the director, wanted to have those names commissioned in an art piece, mm-hmm. and my wife is a graphic artist, an artist, and she has made an art piece with those. I don't think you've seen it, Joe, but
I haven't. I'm going to want to now.
Well, tell you what, you see it, and I guarantee it's going to give you a tear in your eye. It's beautiful.
There were these little pieces of paper, like, you know, like little sticky notes, basically.
Parchment paper.
And it took me two pieces of paper to fill up all the names that I had that day. And it's hard to remember them all without a tear coming down my face. It's hard to think of them all, but I try. I try to hold them differently, and I've written a letter to every damn one of them. And I've talked to them. I've talked to them 1,000 times, both at night and now in the daytime. Now, not only when the darkness and the demons come, now I have a little bit of ways. Well, that's great English. I have ways of speaking to them in the daylight now that I didn't have before. And I can do things in a positive way for them instead of always living in that sadness of why am I alive. And I still, many, many days, ask myself why I'm alive. Why can't I give my life so one of those 19-year-old kids who just had a baby could come home and see his fucking baby? Why am I here, the old mean sergeant who reenlisted a bunch of times and shouldn't be alive anymore, but the 19-year-old kid on his first pump, he got killed? And you ask those questions, and then you say to yourself, instead of brooding over shit I can't change, instead of being an idiot and fighting a battle that you can't win, I'm going to change the tactics, and I'm going to fight in a way that I can win.
You know, to add to what you're saying, I stuffed everything for over 20 years until we had our first reunion.
Man, that happens more than I can tell you. I hear more guys say that. Yeah.
I'll tell you, if you haven't been to a reunion, figure out a way to get there. If you and search it out and find out about it, because being with those people who you got your cherry busted with, you guys share something that never, ever can be shared by anybody else and never will be. And by just you guys coming together or us coming together, we honor those who didn't make it home. And it's interesting. Not everybody goes to reunions. And the guys that I want to see are the ones that I haven't seen at the reunions. Those are my challenge, and we have at Third Recon on we're supposed to call a buddy at least once a week and just say hey, or email them and just check in, and that's really, really important.
All right, I have another question for you. We're going to move on. At what point did you realize that you needed help dealing with your trauma, and how did you go about finding help?
Well, I never did need help. It was the rest of the world that did.
Yeah, hey. Yeah, we're there with you. I'm not wrong. All you bastards are wrong. I'm fucking perfect. Just ask me.
Actually, during my business career, I was able to achieve a certain amount of success. And as long as I was distracted, I was okay. But when I got retired, and 2008 helped that along real fast, and I wasn't prepared to be dropped into oblivion. In other words, I didn't have anything to occupy my mind. And my wife basically said, "You're broken. You better figure out a way to get fixed." And she, I would like to use the word encourage, but it was more than that. She said,
she ordered.
She said, "You're going to this." And I said, "Yeah, right." And I went to a program in Auburn, California called the Forgotten Soldier Program. And I was there under duress for a number of reasons, but the fact that it was called a Forgotten Soldier Program instead of Marine really rubbed me the wrong way. And I actually on the application scribbled out soldier and put Marine on there. And they're a holistic organization that does it through body work and energy work, and it's
all mumbo
jumbo.
I actually
want to
have them come in. I want to have them come in, Donna, and talk. Yeah. I can't wait to see Donna in here. So yeah. Continue.
I talked
Sorry.
To her about you last night, as a matter of fact.
Beautiful.
But they do it through holistic. There's no drugs involved. I'm not somebody who's going to take drugs. I don't care. I'm not going to do it. So there's energy work, and as far as I'm concerned, it's all mumbo jumbo. I don't understand it any more than I understand how when you eat food and it turns it to energy. I know it happens. I just don't know how it happens. And that's the way this energy work works. Is it just relieves the energy level discomfort.
No, it's hard to explain. I went in there. The first time you talked me into going in there, she laid me on a table. She could not have moved my back a millimeter the entire time. And she took my pain away for 24 hours. I don't know if it was voodoo. I don't know if there was a sacrifice made. I don't know what the hell happened. But I didn't hurt for 24 hours. So I don't care. If you need me to bring a chicken, we'll bring goddamn chickens. Like, I don't – whatever you did, it worked. So a lot of times I hear, military members, combat veterans, they say, "Well, that's a bunch of crap." Well, hey, if it works, it's not crap. It doesn't matter what it is. I don't – whatever. Hang a crystal, dance in the moonlight, whatever the hell. If it makes you not hurt and it makes you not stressed, then it's not crazy. And that's the – that's the moral of that story, is it doesn't matter whether or not you understand it. If it makes you feel better, then keep going. I mean, that's the – but go ahead. Continue with that. What else did you do there besides the –
At that point, I met with at this Saturday deal. Matter of fact, it was interesting because I didn't have PTSD. But one of the young men that got up to speak was an Iraqi veteran, and he'd been a truck driver. And – he said that the stresses of driving the roads, knowing that there was an IED out there waiting for him, were what gave him PTSD. And I went, wow, if a truck driver can feel it, then maybe I can too, because of the fact that I can't tell you how many nights I sat there waiting for the enemy to sneak up on our six-man team and obliterate us. So it's the stress of being in combat that really is it. And personally, building up to the contact was the most stressful part. Once you're in contact, you're too busy to be nervous. And then afterwards, after the contact, it's that adrenaline's going through you. And then when the adrenaline stops pumping, that crash, it's like hitting a concrete wall running full speed.
Well, you don't sleep after that. You take a coma. You don't – I mean, when you finally get back to a safe zone and you're finally laying in your rack again or wherever it is that you're taking your next, you don't – I mean, you shake for a while and then you go into a short – I don't know what you call it, but it's not a coma, but it's damn close. Yeah. I mean, because when that crash happens, yeah, and you realize, holy hell, that really just happened. Those guys were
going
actually
over,
trying
going
to get
over
us.
And over what happened, yeah. And figuring out how lucky you were because you zigged instead of zagging.
Yeah. Isn't that
true? It's mind-boggling.
So, okay, you got through Your wife got through to you, got you to the Forgotten Soldier program.
Then went through counseling at the vet center.
How did that come about?
I sat in the parking lot for about 90 minutes waiting.
waiting for somebody to talk you out of it?
Well, waiting for somebody to talk me into it. No. And finally I said, shit, it can't be worse than a firing squad. So I got out of the truck and walked through the door. And that was challenging. But I figured I was tougher than anybody in there, so I could deal with them. And
hell, I could fight my way out if I had to. They're not going to keep me, damn it. So I can get back out if I have to. And the truck's parked in a direction where I could take off quick. If I have to egress. Yeah, I got an egress plan before I walk in this building.
Why is it when you pull into a parking lot, there's a bunch of trucks there, 90% of them are backed in this container.
Hey. Everybody there's got an egress plan, man. We're all ready to roll.
My wife still doesn't understand why I back into a parking space.
No, it's the only place in the world where every single car is parked that way, except the two doctors. You can tell who owns the cars. Oh, Lord, because we're ready to run out if something goes wrong. Somebody brings out the crystals and we're Diddy Mal. Oh, Lordy, Lordy. Okay, so you started at the Veteran Center and then you went through what programs?
Now you're talking about short memory. Went through a deal that described what PTSD is.
That's the 12-week program of PTSD symptoms and symptom suppression.
Okay. And during that deal, there was a Saturday where spouses and family were able to come in. And I think it was a half day for that. And I brought my wife in, and the whole time she's looking at me and tapping me on the shoulder and going, see, I told you so, see, I told you so. And then I had my adult children came in for the second one. My wife, brought them in. And the reason was is to say, your dad's not as crazy as we think he is. He's just got PTSD.
This is a real thing. He's not just mean.
No, I you know, it's interesting. I was never, ever mean to my kids or my wife. But if something happened and I felt threatened, get back.
It's not always them that I mean. Yeah. Mean to people around you, mean to people who cut you off in traffic.
But,
you know, there was a lot, fortunately.
I've not been in fights because of the fact that I guess I had that look in my eye that said, come on, let's do this. And people
I'm
didn't.
Not going to stop at what you consider a stopping point.
Yeah, people back down. And it's fortunate because somebody could have been hurt, and that somebody could have been me too. But I know
he could have ended up in orange. And I don't look good in orange. I don't know about you.
Yeah. I actually look very good in orange.
Well, you know.
I look good in anything.
Apparently, maybe it's the lighting in here. I'm not seeing it. I don't know.
But to say, basically say to the kids, my adult children, that it's just he's going to be okay. And after that, went through the program where we met weekly.
The trauma focus group.
And you got this down.
Oh, yeah. I talk about this too often. I know all the silly words for things.
And that was where I wrote the letter to Cal and letters to others. I bring up Cal. I guess the reason is because of the fact that I had no control over his demise. And we were really tight during training. And just really, really shocked me. But there were others, and I wrote letters to others as well. And I wasn't angry with them for dying, though, interestingly. I wasn't angry because they were doing what they needed to do to protect the team. And it's all about the team. I just recently watched the program Live to Tell about the SEAL team, and man, I tell you what, those guys were saying exactly what I've been living. And that's a hell of a program. It's not for the faint of heart, though.
I was just going to say, if you haven't been through certain things, I don't know if I'd recommend it. Not yet. Eventually, you can sit down and watch certain things, but you need to be in a safe place. You need to be in a safe place mentally and emotionally before you're willing to do those kind of things, because sometimes that can push you into a place of darkness where you have to think about that stuff a little too real before you have maybe contact a doctor first and at least know their number beforehand. That way, if you do get into a dark place, you know how to pull yourself out of it. Because sometimes, man, those movies, they hit a little too close to home, you know. And it's some kid telling you about his experience, and it might not even be your war. Sometimes I'll watch a program, a documentary on X, Y, and Z, you know, the Battle of wherever, and sometimes the guy's talking, especially the old men talking, and it's a little too close to home sometimes. So sometimes you just got to turn it off, but it is what it is. So,
you know, it's interesting you should say that, because Deborah, my wife, has asked me a number of times, why do I put myself through watching those programs? And I really have done a lot of soul searching. Why do I do that? Why do I read those books? And I've come to the conclusion that I need to know that I'm not the only one that has walked that mile. And I need to know that
my reaction was the same as theirs.
Say again?
That my reaction was the same as theirs.
Exactly. Yeah. And that I'm not wacky because of the fact that I love these guys.
We talked about the other day on a different podcast that we were doing with another friend. We talked about how we hold different wars in different esteems. I look back at the guys who did D-Day and I think of them as my personal heroes. I think of them as
absolutely
the hardest guys in the world. And yet when I hear them speak, when you hear the what is that program, like the 7-part series, I can't think of the name of it. Band of Brothers. And at the end of that, when they have the gentleman speaking from that company, and they say same things we do. And you go, holy hell, if these guys can feel it, then it's okay for me to feel it. If these guys are this way, then it's okay in my heart for me to feel this way. Because, again, the stigma of this, it's very hard to get over. I always say this, and I want it to be heard 1,000 times. I don't care what you think. I care what I think when I shave in the morning and I have to look myself in the eyes. I don't care what the rest of the world thinks of my manhood. I know who I am. But sometimes when you feel broken, you don't feel like a whole man. And when you shave in the morning and you look in your own eyes, you go, God, I'm weak. Why am I so weak? And then you hear this guy that you consider a hero say, I feel X, Y, and Z. And you go, oh, well, if that tough bastard can do it, then I'm not weak.
I have developed a softness and a tenderness that I didn't have before. I'm like a freshly baked sourdough roll.
I need to hear the rest of that sentence.
I mean, that crust is it'll ruin your teeth. But man, once you get inside, there is a nice, chewy, sweet center. And I've developed a much less crust and a lot softer center. And I'll tell you, I'm actually happy with it. I have gratitude in my life now and gratefulness and forgiveness. I actually would love to be sitting across the table from one of my Vietnamese counterparts I was just going to ask that question
is, how do you feel about what you used to consider your enemy?
There was one particular contact. You may have read it, Joe. Hungarian, May 21st, 1968. And we were sitting in a bomb crater trying to take a break after a real strenuous hump. And all of a sudden, we're in a crossfire. And after I got home, I was thinking, I was in Golden Gate Park having crab and wine with the guy I went through boot camp with, and my wife, my girlfriend at the time, my wife, and a friend of his. And I'm looking around and I'm thinking, who's going to open fire on us? And I realized that nobody was going to, and I thought, why in the hell am I I was marching through the hills of Vietnam, and all of a sudden we're in a firefight because of the fact that we're in the wrong color uniform. And as it was eye-opening, and yet it was depressing. And I'd like to hear what they had to say now, because I'll tell you what, some of those guys did some pretty brave things. Fortunately, we got fire superiority, and they broke contact, and they had us outnumbered like 3-1. Just blows my mind that we got fire superiority.
Well, we have cooler toys, and I don't mean that as a joke. I mean,
now, the M79 grenade launcher.
It changes a guy's afternoon.
Firing into the trees. Yeah. was what saved our lives.
But I, all I mean is, I used to thank God every morning when we were in country that I was on the side that had helos and tanks and, you know, rockets and all these different things, because if you're the kind of guy who joins the military, you join wherever the hell you were born. And I would have been Moosh. I mean, I don't
– oh, yeah.
You know, if you're the guy who holds a rifle, you're that same guy whatever country you're born in. If I was an Iraqi, I would have been the most loyal Moosh there ever was, and I'd be in that building right now with a bolt-action rifle the same as that dumbass kid. I'm closer to him than I ever was to our elected leaders. I'm closer to that guy than I am to some asshole in Congress. I mean, I'm more like that kid. And when you see their – I always call it depth of faith. When you see a guy who has a weapon that's less – than yours, when you see a guy who is willing to stare down a tank, when you see a guy who's willing to attack a recon platoon, in your case,
there were six of us.
The balls that takes, though, to know that that's a Marine recon element over there. I'm going to go poke it with a stick and see what happens. Okay, I know better. I know what you guys do. I don't poke those guys with a stick. And so when you see the depth of faith of a guy who's a suicide bomber, it's hard not to at least hold his depth of faith in high regard. I don't like what he believes in. I wish I could have a chat with him beforehand and say, "Hey, man, you're getting fed some real serious BS here."
You're liable to get hurt.
But your depth of faith is amazing, and your ability to band yourself to a cause. Just earlier today, I was talking with a friend about kamikazes and their depth of faith. What they believed in was so strong they were willing to drive a plane into a boat. Now, do I agree with what they believe in? No, but that depth of faith is. It's honorable. It's amazing. It's. I mean, you are literally sacrificing yourself for the betterment of your view of society. And how do you not love those guys? Way more than I love, again, our own Congress, who sends us to these places and makes us do these
things.
You definitely
get audited.
Yeah, isn't that true? Yeah, thank God. That'll be fun. any second now, the guys in the suits are knocking. But no, I mean, truly, they're honorable, and when you see other warriors, some of the things that people do in war are horrible. And hell, I was a part of it. You were probably, I mean, everybody who's seen the demon has seen the dark side of it too. But the honorable side of it, knowing that they're somebody else's kid, they're somebody's brother, they're somebody's, you know, husband, wife, whatever. I mean, they're people, and that's one of those things that while you're there, you don't think about. But when you come home and you realize that it was a person that I shot, it wasn't a you know, we dehumanize them while we play the game. And, of course, when the game's over and you come home, you go, wow, that was real. That was a, you know, that wasn't a video game. He doesn't respawn on the other side of the battlefield. You know, he doesn't come back. He doesn't, you know, get a second chance. And thank God, again, we have superior firepower. But they didn't, you know.
I guess the fact that I, as recon, we'd go out for 5 days if we didn't get contact and come back to the rear for 5 days. And the infantry of the Vietnam era, they'd go out for 30, 40, 50, 60 days and live, eat, sleep in the bush. And I was – I think we were doing a Rough Rider, and I was at Cam Low.
Explain a Rough Rider, because, again, some of the people who listen are
family members.
Basically,
a Rough Rider is that on a convoy, it's a transportation unit that's transporting stuff – logistics to a combat base outside, and they need to have a defensive unit on board.
You guys are the shotgun.
Yeah. So yeah. The first two or three trucks have got infantry or what appears to be infantry on them, and the last few trucks and maybe a couple in the center of the convoy, so that if you get into an ambush, our job was to jump off the truck and sweep through the ambush and destroy it. So it's basically a show of force. But it was a Cam Low, which was within artillery distance from North Vietnam. And there was a concertina, barbed wire, barricade, and there were refugees inside, mostly children and women. And there was one young man in there who was like 19 years old, and he had a toe that was badly, badly infected. And I spotted him, pulled him out, there and had a corpsman look at it, and the corpsman agreed that he needed to go to Bravo Med. So we get him on a truck and send him back to Bravo Med. And after it's all over, I think to myself, that son of a bitch probably got that infected climbing through concertina wire into a sapper. or something like that, because he was definitely of military age. And it didn't even occur to me that until after the incident was over, because of the fact that the natural humanity of the American serviceman took over before any brutal thoughts did. And I think that's one of the things that the United States has got going for it that no other – well, maybe some other powers do. But there's definitely still humanity amongst our combat people.
Well, and the humanity is what gives us PTSD. That's the whole problem, is the fact that we do care and we do feel, because I say this all the time. PTSD is not a condition of what happened. It's a condition of what happened and how it made you feel. And you know – the fact that you – I'm going to ask this as a question rather than as a statement. How many nights have you wondered what he did after you helped him?
TFM, two frappin' many.
Yeah. And that's one of the problems, is because you say, I did what was right, but was it right? I did what I thought was right, but again, at 3 in the morning when you're alone and you're in your bed and you think, God, did he later go to – be the coolest guy in Vietnam who fixed everything, or did he go on patrols and kill my friends? And you'll never know the answer. We talked about this last night. Again, me and another friend were doing this, and we talked about this last night in our scenarios, but not ever knowing is what's – it's worse than if I knew. Even if I knew what he did and it was bad, at least I would have that knowledge and I could quantify it and I could say, well, at least I tried to do the right thing. But when you don't know, that's what eats you alive. That's what makes this disease, I hate to use that word, this problem, this post-combat normal vision of life, that's what makes it so horrible, because you can't get an answer to that question. And well, you don't know the guy's name. You don't know where to find him. You don't know how to look it up. There's no answer, and that's a pain in the ass.
Disease is a very descriptive word when you really get right down to it, because it's two words, dis, which means un, and ease, which means comfortable. Yeah. So we're uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And so I don't like to use the word disease either, because of the fact that I don't feel like I'm broken. I feel like I'm damaged perhaps a little bit, but I'm not broken.
Me and my family call it shaken daddy syndrome. But well, I mean, because there's just moments where you go, I don't have a disorder. I have what a human being feels when they see and do horrible things. I have emotion towards seeing my friends torn limb from limb. I have emotion towards seeing my friends not come home.
Well, I like to call it PTS,
yeah,
not PTSD.
Well, and again, that's why we went even further and called it post-combat normal, because you're normal. You are normal for the scenario that you lived through. You're not post anything. You're living with what you did, and that's normal. That's perfectly normal to feel that way. It's not – you know, I'm not a disease. I'm not a disorder. I am a person who did certain things. And I live with those choices. If you eat fast food, you get fat. You don't have fat disorder. You just eat food. If you run every day and you can run farther than me, you don't have running disorder. You're just what a runner looks like. I mean, and so I hate that we call it these things, because that's what gives it a stigma. That's what makes it to where kids who are 19 don't want to go in and get help, because, well, I don't want to have a disorder. Well, you don't, brother. You're post-combat normal. But again, let's move on to the next question. We can actually you called Vietnam the fulcrum of your life. I love that sentence. I absolutely love that sentence. What do you mean by that?
Where I no longer was a child or a youth. I called the Marine Corps the fulcrum of my life.
Okay.
Because the boot camp experience was actually not that challenging for me. It wasn't, oh my God, this is horrible, because I knew what I was getting into. I used to laugh under my breath at the drill instructors when they were just working us over, because of the fact that I knew that was their job and they were only doing what they were supposed to be doing, nothing more, nothing less. And then got into normal training. I thought, oh my gosh, you know, boot camp's over. This is going to be a piece of cake. Well, it got harder.
Yeah, people always think boot camp's tough, and then they get to the real training and they're like, holy hell.
Yeah, what did I get myself into? You know what? It made me a man. When I came home from Vietnam, I said, the toughest time of my life is over, so it's downhill from here. Au contraire.
Then you walked into a vet center one day.
Yeah, 40 years later. 40 years later, I'm looking back and going, geez. But the Marine Corps prepared me for life. it made me a better, stronger person, made me a more dedicated person to whatever mission I chose to accomplish. I was very fortunate in my sales career to earn the Salesman of the Year in an organization that had 70 outside salespeople. I did a good job, and the national sales manager says, "How did you do it?" Because I was a rookie at the time. I was almost a brand new sales guy. But he said, "How did you do it?" And I said, "Well, I sat down, reviewed the criteria to become Salesman of the Year, reviewed it strongly, developed a plan, and I set out and executed my plan." And he was an old Army captain, and he says, "So your mission was to accomplish it." And I said, "That's what I did. I just did it." And it made it simple for me. In many of life's difficulties, the Marine Corps has made simple for me.
One of my favorite things I've ever heard, Marines always talk a certain way. We are different than all the other services. And I love all you brothers out there who are in different services. I really do. But there's a special place in my heart for these weirdos that wear my Eagle Global Anchor with me. And there was this study done, and I want to say it was Berkeley, but bear with me. It could have been Stanford, somewhere here locally in California. And they did a study about people reintegrating into society and how long it took different services to reintegrate. And it was basically like the Air Force took about 4 weeks, and they were reintegrated. They got their DD-214. They got out of the military. And about 4 weeks later, they were back to basically who they were. And the Navy was like 8 weeks. And the Army infantry guys took about a year to recover and become more or less who they used to be. And at the end of the study, in small letters, it said, "Marines never recover." Because they think what we have is not right. And at the same time, all of us think that it's amazing, because the intangible things that it gives us, the pride, the discipline, the ability to attack any problem as if it were simple, you break it down into a 5-paragraph order and you execute. You just go. Damn it, go. Headbutt it till it dies. And those things are powerful to us. But again, Marines never recover. So whenever somebody hears me say that, they're like, "What do you mean?" Well, I laugh about it all the time, because we don't. The noise, actually, in this podcast, you're probably hearing a dinging noise. That's the Marine Corps flag flying 20 feet above my house in the high wind outside. Why? Because I want people to know that I'm not a recovered human being. There is a reason that my house looks a certain way. And most of us have those kind of things, because we are. We are what we are. So you've gone through the Forgotten Soldier Program, and you've gone through the Veterans Center. You've gone through a whole lot of things. You saw your poem become a musical thing. You've done all these things. What symptoms do you still find, even after all that, the hardest to battle?
I'm a lot better, but I'm still a little bit broken. I guess the ability to keep from launching into that combat mode is the one that there's a little bit of knowing that you can't take something back, I guess, whether it be words or an action, but just taking that 3 seconds to gather myself before I react.
Using your logical brain.
Hopefully it'll be 10 seconds instead of just 3 seconds. Because I can pretty much wilt a full-grown plant with words if the occasion should arise. But I'm learning to temper those words and the physical actions.
That's outstanding. One of my last questions for you is, if you could tell a young man who just got back from combat – no. Let me think about that differently. If you could see yourself getting off the plane from Vietnam, what would you tell yourself about getting help? How would you talk yourself into getting in immediately and before 40 years of waiting?
If you sprained your ankle or broke your thumb or cracked a rib, would you wait 40 years before you put a splint on it?
Okay, Brendan, it was great to have you in today. Is there anything you'd like to add at the end of this before we wrap it up?
Don't wait.
Don't wait. I love it. All right, man.
kind of direct and to the point, right?
Hey, honestly, I mean, that's what – you're a Marine. I expect that. We we want these kids to get in. We want them to get the help that they need. For those of you who've listened today and may be feeling some emotions, I don't want to put anybody in a place where they feel emotions and they don't have a way to get help. So there's a couple things I want you to do. If you're feeling like you need help immediately, the Veterans Crisis Line is 1-800-273-8255 and Veterans press 1. Again, it's 1-800-273-TALK. TALK is 8255. Press 1 if you're a veteran and they'll immediately talk to you. They'll get you whatever help you need. If it's not an immediate thing and you need a little bit of more complex help, feel free to look us up on Google at – put quotes around it. Type in post-combat normal. You'll find Twitter. You'll find Facebook. You'll find emails. All different ways to get a hold of us, all different ways. And any of those ways that you get a hold of me, I will find something for you locally that can help you. And if I can't, I will find you someone who can. There are – veterans all around you who care. There are people who love you. There are people who want to help you. There are so many organizations out there that want you to get the help that you need. Let's get it. Let's. All you have to do is man up and start going. And I know that sucks.
Man or a woman up.
Yeah, exactly. Man or a woman up. Again, infantry brain. Sorry. you know, I'm around a certain type of people, so I think a certain type of way. But again, anybody that needs help, no matter what your situation, no matter what happened, please contact somebody, get the help. So again, I love you guys. Hope you guys have a great week, and I will talk to you later.